Welcome back to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price. I am joined solo today by Chad Bird. Chad, how's it going?
The bird's flying solo. Well, with you. But it's good. It's good.
I don't count.
Yeah. Well, just two of us today. I guess Brandon is under the weather, so we're just going to have to handle this on our own.
You, me, and Joseph, and his 11 brothers.
Yeah, there's a whole passel of us today. And what a mess we have. Good grief.
Well, things are about to get interesting with our pal Joseph.
Yes, they are. His life is about to take a rather unexpected turn from what he's experienced the first 17 years of his life.
Yeah. So which chapter and verse are we in?
Well, we started chapter 37 last time, which is the beginning of this extensive narrative that mainly focuses on Joseph. We're gonna switch in the next chapter back to Judah. But besides that, pretty much the rest of Genesis in one way or another is about Joseph. So we started it last time. We got about halfway through. I guess we're just around verse 18. So we covered about half the chapter last time. And up to this point, what's happened with Joseph? Well, first of all, he's the favorite son because he's the firstborn son of Jacob's favorite wife of his four wives. He's the son of Jacob's old age, and Jacob makes no bones whatsoever about the fact that Joseph's his favorite. He loves him more than all the other brothers, and to show that, he gives him this multicolored tunic or this long robe or coat of many colors, whatever you want to call it, that says to everybody who sees Joseph wearing this, oh, look, it's Jacob's favorite son. Now, of course, this causes great anger and jealousy and even hatred. Not just anger, jealousy, but even hatred by his brothers, who, like their moms, are not loved as much by Jacob as they wish. And to make matters worse, as we talked about in the first half of this chapter, Joseph has these dreams in which not only his brothers, but his mom and his father bow down to him. And he makes the mistake of telling them about these dreams, which just increases the hatred of his brothers against him all the more. And then we kind of finished off last time talking about how his brothers are a few days south of where Jacob and the rest of the clan are living. And so quite foolishly, Jacob sends Joseph to check on them. I don't know what he was thinking. You know, ordinarily Jacob's a pretty smart guy, but he's making all sorts of stupid mistakes in this chapter. But when I say smart, I mean he acts in a way that is beneficiary, in which he is the beneficiary of the actions. But this time, he's making all kinds of foolish decisions. And the foolish decision he makes is to send Joseph down to check on his brothers. So that's where Joseph, that's kind of where we left off. Joseph gets lost along the way and he finds this man. We assume it's a man, could have been an angel, who knows, but this man who directs him back to where his brothers are. So that's kind of a recap. That takes us through the verse 17 of the chapter. And we'll pick it up here with 18, which is really where the action gets kind of crazy. And we have three different possibilities of what might happen to Joseph, depending on which brother or group of brothers you talk to. So here's how it starts. It says, when they, that is the brothers, when they saw Joseph from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. So things have escalated quickly, as we say. They've gone from hating him, not being able to even act like they're friendly toward him, to now they want to put him to death. It's basically another Cain and Abel scenario. Cain was jealous of Abel, so he rose up against him and killed him in the field, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And the same thing's about to happen here to Joseph, at least if the brothers have their way. Now, what we're not told right away is that probably the reason the brothers saw him at a distance was it because he was wearing this this neon sign that blinked, "I am the Father's favorite," as he was coming up to them. So the brothers are looking in the distance, and they see a guy coming, and it's obvious that it's Joseph because he's wearing his coat of many colors. I mean, this would be like waving a red flag in front of a bull. This is not a wise decision on Joseph's part. It's not like he had to wear that coat, but he does. And he gets the reaction that you might expect. So we know that at least eight of the brothers want to kill him. So that the majority opinion is they want to put him to death. And then they add this afterward. They say, and so they say one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let's kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." So, I guess it's the dreams that's really the unhealed wound on these brothers. That's really what gets to them. That was kind of the acme, I guess, of everything going on. It was bad enough that, Joseph was a favorite and that Jacob loved him, but now he has these dreams in which he rubs salt into their wounds. So that's their plan. The brothers want to take care of this once and for all.
Well, it makes sense that they're irritated by him being their father's favorite, and they don't like Joseph because of that. But that's not entirely Joseph's fault. Walking in all cocky with your dreams, well, that's a whole different thing, right?
Yeah, that's a whole different ballgame. That's right.
That's another level. And so if he was like this awesome dude who, he was dad's favorite, but he wasn't a snitch.
Yeah, he's one of those people that it's hard not to like anyway, right?
Right, where you're like, well, I mean, Joseph's pretty awesome, so, I mean, I get it. He's so nice and just wanting the best for everyone. Who wouldn't like him? No, it's not really like that. It's more like his dad's favorite, and now he's just like rocking that coat 24/7, and now he's telling us about his dreams, or we like fall down and worship him. And yeah, all right. And on top of all that, like right before he does all that stuff, like he totally snitched us out to dad.
Oh yeah, I forgot to mention that detail. Yeah, he brought back a bad report about his brothers. Yeah. He's gone past the three strikes. You know, he's on to like five or six by now.
Yeah. And his brothers aren't the kind of dudes that won't, talk you into getting circumcised and then kill you while you're healing. I mean, they're not.
Yeah, these are not guys to mess with. Yeah. I mean, Simeon and Levi, who would have been among these brothers that plotted to kill him. They already had the taste of blood. They'd wiped out a whole city. I mean, not just one man, but a whole city had wiped out with their swords after their daughter, after their sister was kidnapped and raped.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you don't mess with these guys.
Yeah, the way these guys get even is documented.
Yeah. Yeah, they have a track record already. And Joseph, for all his wisdom later in life, is still kind of has that teenage foolishness going on here. I guess he's so cocksure of himself that he doesn't see what's coming. You know, he's kind of the invincible teen, right? He'll be fine. Nothing's going to happen to him. And evidently, Jacob is under the same delusion because he sends Joseph down there to check on his brothers. But we have to say this: at least one of the brothers, Reuben, quite unexpectedly. Reuben is not in favor of this. So Reuben, as we've heard before, he's the firstborn. He's the son of Leah, and what we know about him is minimal. But we do know that, as we talked, I think a couple of episodes ago, that the Reuben tried to kind of exert his own authority over his father by sleeping with his father's concubine. After Rachel died, He slept with her maidservant, who was one of Jacob's co-wives. So that is definitely going to come back to haunt Reuben, and probably already at this point has. So Reuben says, Reuben hears him talking, and it says he rescued him, that is Joseph, out of their hands. And he says, don't take his life, shed no blood. He says, throw him into this pit. I guess there was a pit close by that's in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him. Then we have kind of this parentheses where it says that he did this that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. So even though the majority of the brothers wanted just basically to murder Joseph, at least Reuben, for some reason, and I have a couple of suspicions as to why, decides that he wants to rescue Joseph. Now, here's my two suspicions as to why. First of all, it could be that simply he is acting out of his duty as the oldest brother. He's the one who is supposed to be the protector of the group. And you see this later on in the story as well, where Reuben tries to put himself out as kind of the sacrificial lamb to his dad, saying that, if anything happens, let his life be taken. So that could be one of the reasons. And another reason could be that he's trying to get back into the good graces of his father. Because, I mean, think of it this way. If Reuben is able to rescue Joseph out of the hands of his brothers and to take him back to Jacob safe and sound, and to tell Jacob what his other brothers have been up to, hey, this is a chance to redeem himself, right? He's going to make himself look good in the eyes of his father, and maybe all the bad blood between them will be taken care of. So whatever the reason is, that's what Reuben's plan is, and it doesn't work out so well. But we'll get back to that in a minute. Joseph gets there. When Joseph reached his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his coat of many colors, and they took him, and they threw him into the pit. Now, the pit was empty without any water in it. A little detail added there. Evidently, these pits were used in various places in the wilderness to store water. They're basically a cistern. It's like a big pot underground, if you will. It has a very narrow top, and then it widens out as you go underneath the ground. They would ordinarily line them with something which would prevent the loss of water. So they were basically a cistern in which you kept maybe rainwater or something like this. This one, of course, was dry, and it worked as a perfect jail for Joseph while they tried to figure out what to do with him. We actually have one of the cases where a cistern like this was used as a jail cell, because Jeremiah was in chapter 38. Jeremiah was also placed in custody and lowered down into a cistern like this by those who had taken him captive. So that's where we find Joseph. He gets his tunic taken away, he's seized, and he's thrown into the pit. And then we have this detail added, which maybe I brought this up last time, which I've always found to be rather enlightening, because as soon as it says that they threw him in the pit, the very next verse says, then they sat down to eat a meal. So you've got these brothers who have just turned on their own brother, put him in a pit, want to kill him, are trying to figure out what they do, but in no way does this affect their appetite.
They had a picnic near the pit.
Yeah, they put the picnic blankets down, sit around, have their lunch. And even though it's not recorded here, in chapter 42, later on, the brothers recall that Joseph was pleading with them. So it kind of gives a little bit more color to this scene. I mean, it's bad enough that Joseph is in the pit, but he's actually pleading with them. So while their brother is begging for his life, they are sitting around breaking bread and trying to figure out what they're going to do with him. I mean, as you go through the story, the callousness of the brothers just hardens just more and more as you proceed through the story, to where there's this capacity for humans of inhumanity is remarkable. The inability, or the refusal rather, to show compassion is really hardly knows any bounds. And we see that in the case of the brothers here. Now, there's also elements in this story which are foreshadowings of what's going to come later, because here we have the brothers who have all the power over the life of Joseph, sitting around eating a meal while he is separated from them in the bottom of a pit. Then in chapter 43, much later in the story, everything is reversed, because on the second trip that the brothers take to Egypt, once more there is a meal, and once more they are separated from Joseph, except now Joseph is not in the pit, but he's on the throne, and it's not the brothers who hold the authority over the power over the life of Joseph, but it's Joseph who holds the power over their own lives. She kind of got these two meals that play off against each other, and thus reveal the turning of the tables that happened in the life of Joseph, where before he's at the point of death, cut off from his brothers. In the end, God exalts him so that he gives life to his brothers, and it all culminates in a meal in which a decision is made. So here they are, Joseph in a pit, brothers eating, and lo and behold, almost as if by divine intervention, which of course it was, it says they looked up, and behold, here comes a caravan of Ishmaelites. They were coming down from Gilead. They had all these camels, and these camels had aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, and they were on their way to Egypt. Now, this is another one of those kind of parallels in the story of Joseph, because on the brothers' second trip down to Egypt, these are some of the same elements that they will carry themselves. These items that were used for bartering, for trade, as they went down into Egypt to purchase grain. So you got another kind of play in the story there. And maybe this is a stretch, but as I was looking at this morning, I couldn't help but make the connection there to the gifts of the wise men to Jesus too. They bring him gold and frankincense and myrrh, and they bring this immediately before Jesus makes his own journey down into Egypt, which, you know, the gold, the frankincense and myrrh, I mean, that was the means by which that Joseph and Mary were able to sustain themselves when they were on their journey. And it kind of puts into bold relief, really, the fact that this whole story of Joseph could really be called the passion narrative of Joseph, or his suffering and his death and his resurrection, because throughout the story, Joseph is a type or foreshadowing of the life of Jesus. It's like what you read in Joseph's life is in black and white, and then it's colored in when you get to the life of the one whom he foreshadowed. Because in the life of Joseph, you have the same things happening then in the life of Jesus. I mean, he's betrayed by his brothers. He's sold for the pieces of silver. He's betrayed at a meal, just as Joseph was. And just as Joseph goes down and then goes down and then finally goes down into the very pits of the prison there in Egypt, so Christ goes down and down and down until he finally is in the tomb after his own crucifixion. So Luther, in his commentary on the Joseph story, talks repeatedly about the crucifixion of Joseph and about the resurrection of Joseph and about the exaltation of Joseph. So he depicts this story in Christological terminology, so that what we see in the life of Joseph is, as we do in many cases in the Old Testament, but we're shadowing what we see in the life of our Lord.
Yeah, I mean, so Joseph is young and impetuous and does things that are probably not wise, to say the least. that wind him up in this situation where his brothers can't stand him and they're going to want to kill him. However, it's sort of from this point on where Joseph's going to pretty much crush it from here on out. We're gonna really struggle to figure out some places where Joseph is a real jerk. Man, he's just a terrible guy. Like he's gonna pretty much do right and
he's pretty much squeaky clean after this. Except Well, maybe when he deceives his brothers. But anyway, yeah. I agree.
Yeah,
you're right.
And so you're going to have this type of Christ even kind of go on there where he does the right thing with Potiphar's wife and gets punished for it, you know, and hooks up the cupbearer or whatever, you know, and then like gets forgotten.
Yeah, right.
And so like, yeah, you'll see this play out where Joseph is he's pretty righteous. As far as Egypt goes, Joseph is pretty righteous and he is treated pretty crappy a lot of the time, and then he also gets rewarded a lot of the time too. You see his resurrection, as it were.
Yeah, I think of all biblical characters, as well in Genesis for sure, he is one of those who really is kind of living this kind of theology of the life, sort of theology of the cross sort of life, which is completely Christ-like in nature, in that he, you know, no good deed goes unpunished with him. Right. It's like every good thing that he does ends up with some sort of punishment until finally he is exalted to the right hand of Pharaoh. But yeah, this is a turning point, and it seems like after this he kind of loses that youthful big-headedness that he exhibited with his brothers early on. I mean, by the end of the story, he's very different because he doesn't throw dreams in their face. Instead, he throws absolution at them. He forgives them and does not seek in any way to punish them, even though he held all authority to do so. By that point in his life, he had come to realize that the reason all of this happened to him was that it was part of God's plan to provide physical protection, physical life, physical salvation for Egypt as well as for Jacob and his family. So kind of getting back to the story, we'll see what happens next. So they see these band of Ishmaelites who are coming, and then we kind of have the third option. I mentioned three options earlier. So most of the brothers wanted to kill him. Reuben steps in. He has the authority of the firstborn. He says, no, it's not what we're going to do. Let's just put him in a pit. And then Reuben evidently, by this point, is somewhere else, as we're going to discover in a moment. He's not with the brothers at this moment. Maybe he's gone back to check on the sheep. We really don't know, but he's not with everyone else as the following events transpire. So here comes the third option. So Reuben wants to save him. Most of the brothers want to kill him. And then Judah steps up. And I believe, I could be wrong here, I believe these are the first recorded words of Judah. Judah said to his brothers, after they saw this caravan of Ishmaelites, he says, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Now, as I've said before, I am so glad that I did not live in Bible times, because not only would my actions be recorded, many of which are not things that I want preserved for all generations, but my words would be as well. So Judah's first recorded words are, "Hey, we're not going to make any money if we kill our brother. Let's just sell him.
He is our brother, after all.
He is our brother, after all. I mean, it's not like we can kill him. Let's just sell him to these Midianite, Ishmaelite traders. Make our 20 shekels of silver."
It's a weird thing.
I mean, the reasoning of the sinful mind is not rational. It doesn't make any sense. Man, this is our brother. we can't do anything that's really bad, so let's just do something that's bad.
It starts off with this reasoning: hey, if we kill him, we don't make any money, and he is our brother. After all, like, it's like this weird thing where it's like, are you saying that, like, that you shouldn't kill him because he's your brother? Or it almost sounds like he's saying, hey, we can make some money off this guy if we sell him. And that would be a merciful thing to do.
Yes.
He is our brother, after all. Maybe we should have mercy on him and just sell him into slavery.
Yeah. The mercy of the old Adam is not very merciful.
No, it's not. No.
This is a great case of where a person tries to choose between the lesser of two evils, but it just underlines the fact that he still chose an evil.
Yeah, there is a third option, you know.
Yeah, there is a third option. How about stand up with your brother Reuben and say, listen, it doesn't matter how much we hate him. It doesn't matter, you know, how much he's angered us by telling us his dreams. He's our brother. And so pull him out of the pit and give him a good talking to. But hey, you know, we're brothers. We love, we forgive, we reconcile. And we may not always get along, but we're not going to kill each other. We're not going to sell each other into slavery. We're not going to destroy each other's lives and the lives of our father and the rest of our family.
I mean, putting your little brother in a pit while you eat lunch, like, that's something I can see myself doing.
Like, yeah, I mean, yeah, all right. Yeah. Brothers. Yeah, you can see brothers doing something like that. Yeah,
it's like, hey, you just stay down there. And then me even telling you, like, I'm just leaving you down there. I'm just going to leave you down there.
I'm going to close you. I'm going to put you in the closet and lock the door.
As soon as I finish this sandwich, I'm out of here and you're staying down there. Just freak him out. And then, yeah, you know, but you go get him afterwards.
Yeah, he is your brother after all. Oh, so
it reminds me, this is totally irrelevant, but this is what maybe some of the listeners don't have brothers. This is how brothers do. Me and my brother, who's a year younger than me, we used to go out in the woods and play all the time. Well, when we were like 12 and 13, I have another brother who's 5 years younger than that. And so he was about, I don't know, like eight at the time. And my mom was like, you take your brother with you.
And of course you didn't want to.
No, we didn't want to. She said, take Josiah with you. And we're like, oh, man. So, and he was mom and dad's favorite for sure. But anyway, so we took him out there and we told him this long story about how we were hunting this massive wolf named Sharp Fang. And we were like, and,
scare the kid to death.
Yeah. And we're like, we're hunting him and it's like, and he's it's crazy. And so like, and he's like, oh, okay, all right. So he's with us, and once we got like him all convinced about this thing that we were out there to do, we ran and left him there. And then we circled back around and just made sounds and just watched him freak out. Like,
that's perfect. That's what brothers do, that's right? What
I do. Like, mom, you said to play with our brother. That's exactly what we did.
There's all sorts of play.
We played with him real good. So yeah, I get like, yeah, you can throw your little brother in a pit, eat a sandwich while he's down there, tell him that, you know, a wolf's gonna come eat him. I don't know, but by the way, we did not leave him out there.
Yeah.
He is our brother after all.
Yeah, you didn't go find the meanest dog in the neighborhood and sick him on your brother. No. Right? I mean, there are lines that even brothers are not supposed to cross. So Joseph's brothers evidently did not know about those lines. So they do what they do. They listen to Judah, and they pull him out of the pit. It says Midianite traders or Ishmaelite traders. In later parts of scripture, these are synonymous. So no big deal about who these people are. Midianites, Ishmaelites, they're all part of the same group of people. So they pull him up, lift Joseph out of the pit, and they sell him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus, they brought Joseph into Egypt. So 20 shekels of silver. A shekel, by the way, is not a coin. Later it was, but at this time, a shekel is just a unit of weight. So however much 20 shekels was, kind of like the British pound. I mean, it's a term of measurement. So 20 shekels of silver, and we know from Leviticus, for instance, that 20 shekels of silver was the going price for a male servant, a male slave at this time. So more or less, they are not only selling him into slavery, their own brother, but they're selling him for the same amount that they would get for a slave, which is a further insult. It's not like, they even said to themselves, you know what? We should at least ask a higher price for, since he is our brother after all. But they treat him like he's nothing but a slave to them. So that's the way it goes down. Now, I was just thinking of this morning, and again, maybe it's just one of those coincidences, but isn't it interesting that the person who was behind this, the person who was behind the idea of selling out their brother for 20 shekels of silver was named Judah. And the person who was responsible for selling out his brother Jesus for 30 pieces of silver was also named Judah, because Judas, that name of the Judas Iscariot, is nothing but the Greek form of the Hebrew name Judah. So in both cases, you've got the same guy with the same name who comes up with a plan to make some money off the selling of off the betrayal of a brother.
That's really interesting. And the one that ends up receiving the birthright,
Yes, he is. Exactly.
which is bizarre, because Jacob will say, okay, no, I'm not going to give it to the oldest because he hooked up with my co-wife,
Right.
so you're disqualified.
So he's out, right?
He's not righteous enough. I'm not going to give it to these next two dudes because, they were shedding blood like crazy over at the whole rape of Dinah thing. So they're out. I'll give it to Judah. He seems pretty upstanding, righteous dude. And it's like, well, I don't know if this is any better.
Don't know what standard you're using, but yeah.
He's the dude that came up with the let's sell your favorite son into slavery.
Right. And as we'll see in the next chapter too, I mean, the next chapter about Judah and Tamar tells us even more about what kind of guy Judah was. So yeah, I mean, Jacob's criteria are definitely, I mean, if they're like some kind of moral categories that that Jacob has, then he's got a weird system of morality. That's for sure. So incest is out, murdering is out, but if you only sell your brother and then have incest with your daughter-in-law, then that's fine.
You're the guy for me.
You're the guy for me. Yeah. But I mean, it is true that beginning here, this is the first hint of it. Beginning here, Judah begins to emerge as the leader of his brothers. And they listen. It says, they didn't kill him, so they did listen to Reuben. But really, the one who convinces him as to what they should do is Judah. And as the story goes on, Reuben's leadership will basically disappear, and Judah's leadership will emerge, because he's the one, in fact, that Jacob puts in charge of their return to Egypt, and the one who basically is in charge of the clan after that. So it's like, even before he gives the blessing in chapter 49, Jacob has decided that Judah is the one that he's going to pass on his baton of leadership to. But yeah, it's a strange reasoning in the mind of Jacob. But Jacob's kind of a strange guy, so I guess maybe that's what we should expect. So they took Joseph down into Egypt. They is the traitors. Now we got to back up a little bit here, because Reuben reenters the scene now. So Reuben, as I mentioned earlier, he wasn't around when all this decision making was going on. So he returns to the pit and looks in there, and Joseph's not in the pit. And so he tears his garments And then he goes to his brothers and says, the boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go? It's almost like he's talking to himself. More or less like, you know, Joseph's lost. Now what's going to happen to me? So it seems to me like Reuben is really clueless as to what actually happened.
Right.
Now, maybe, you know, maybe he had a suspicion, but it, usually when you tear your garments, that's a symbol of mourning. As at the end of the chapter, Jacob's going to tear his garments when he assumes that Joseph is dead. So it's almost like Reuben's decided that they actually did go through with the killing. In fact, later on in the story, in chapter 42, Reuben talks about how he says something like, you know, basically we're being paid back for the blood of our brother. So it's almost like he was convinced this whole time that they actually did kill Joseph. So that's what happens with Reuben. And then the story goes on. So we're about to run out of time here, so we want to wrap this up. So here's what the brothers do. Their old Adam, by the way, is hard at work here. I mean, he is having a heyday. So they've lied. They've stole their brother. They've acted maliciously. But it gets even worse now because they have to cover up their crime. So they take the coat of many colors. They kill this male goat. They dip the tunic in the blood. And then they send it. They don't go themselves, but they send servants or someone with this bloody tunic. And to take it to their father with this message that we found this, please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not. Now, there's a bit of, I can't call it humorous irony because this is really not funny, but there is a bit of irony here because remember that it was through by means of clothing and goat skin that Jacob deceived his own father to get the blessing. And now his own sons are using clothing and goat skin to and a goat to deceive their father. So he sees it, and he says, it's my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. And he mourns for his son many days. It says his sons and his daughters rose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. So it's a terrible picture here of the brothers who are guilty of all this. They're lying. They see how much this has distressed their father. And it's almost like, you know, they're almost like they're enjoying this because they got what they wanted, right? And then they're lying to him, trying to comfort him, all the while covering up what they've done.
And they're gonna, and here's the thing, like they're gonna hold out on this confession for a very long time.
Yeah, it's gonna be a skeleton in their closet for many years to come, and it doesn't go away. In fact, as soon as things go south when they get down into Egypt, the first thing that they say is, "This is happening to us because of what we did to our brother Joseph." So it's like over time it began to eat on them like a cancer, and they interpreted negative events in their life in light of what they'd done to Joseph. So later they regretted it, to be sure. And this guilt plagued them because of what they'd done. But behind all this, to kind of wrap everything up, behind all of this is the unmentioned God. God is not mentioned in this chapter, even though he's there throughout the whole story, because he's the one who is guiding these events. It says that, you know, the servants, the Midianite traders, are the ones who brought Joseph down into Egypt. But it really wasn't them, because as Joseph himself will say later, it was not you who sent me here, but God. So God is the one who's at work through all of this treachery, jealousy, hatred, pride, lying. He's at work beneath all of this sin. It's just like he's at work beneath everything going on in our lives, in order to bring about the effect that he desires. So this is theology of the cross stuff, the hidden God, the God who works backwards from what we expect, who, when we see black, he sees white. When we see darkness, he sees light. He's the one who works opposite to what we expect, especially in our suffering and deprivation. He hides himself so that in that hiddenness, he can be at work to do for us what he ultimately desires, which in the case of this story is the salvation of Egypt and all these lands. And in our case, it's our own salvation that he will bring out of our sufferings and our pain and everything else and our sins, everything else, our ultimate good, which is the salvation of our souls and the resurrection of our bodies.
That is true, and that is it.
Very good, very good.
My man. Well, guys, thanks for hanging out with us. It was fun. Hey, if you're interested in going to city events, if you're in the New York City area or in the Dallas area, we're coming to you. New York City in June 11th, and then we will be in Dallas October 29th. So if you are in either of those areas or can make it to either of those places, you should definitely come out and see us. And you can find more information about that over at ChristOldFast.org and just go to city events and you'll see everything you need is right there. All right. Thanks for hanging out. We will see you next time.